Conrad Berg arrived, still using a stick and limping heavily, as he would for the rest of his life. From the hide, he watched the herd with Deborah and David, and then back at the homestead, he sat before the log fire, eating prime beefsteak and drinking Old Buck while he gave his opinion. "They aren't from the park, I shouldn't think. I would have recognized a big old bull like that if I'd ever seen him before. They've probably sneaked in from one of the other estates. You haven't got a south fence up yet, have you?"
"No, not yet."
"Well, that's where they've moved from. Probably sick of being stared at by all the tourists. Come up here for a bit of peace." He took a swallow of his gin. "You're getting a nice bit of stuff together here, Davy. Another few years and it'll be a real show place. Have you got any plans for visitors? You could make a good thing out of this place, like they have at Mala Mala. 5-star safaris at economy prices."
"Connie, I'm just too damn selfish to want to share this with anybody else."
The distractions and the time had given Deborah an opportunity to recover from the American failure of A Place of Our Own. And one morning she sat down at her desk and began working again on her second novel. That evening she told David, "One of the blocks I have had is that I hadn't a name for it. It's like a baby. You have to give it a name or it's not really a person."
"You have got a name for it?" he asked.
"Yes."
"Would you like to tell me?"
She hesitated, shy at saying it to some other person for the first time. "I thought I'd call it A Bright and Holy Thing," she said.
And he thought about it for a few moments, repeating it softly.
"You like it?" she asked anxiously.
"It's great," he said. "I like it, I really do."
With Deborah once more busy on her novel, it seemed each day was too short for the love and laughter and industry which filled it. The call came through while David and Deborah were sitting around the barbecue in the front garden. David ran up to the house when the telephone bell insisted. "Miss Mordecai?" David was puzzled. The name was vaguely familiar.
"Yes, I have a person-to-person call from New York for Miss Deborah Mordecai," the operator repeated impatiently, and David realized who she was talking about.
"She'll take it," he said, and yelled for Deborah. It was Bobby Duggan, and the first time she had heard his voice. "Wonder Girl," he shouted over the line. "Sit down so you don't fall down. Big Daddy has got news for you that'll blow your mind. Cosmopolitan ran the article on you 2 weeks ago. They did you real proud, darling. Full-page photograph. God, you look good enough to eat."
Deborah laughed nervously and signaled David to put his ear against hers to listen.
"The mag hit the stand Saturday, and Monday morning was a riot in the bookstores. They were beating the doors down. You've caught the imagination of everybody here, darling. They sold 17,000 hardback in 5 days. You jumped straight into the number 5 slot on the New York Times bestseller list. It's a freak, a phenomenon, a mad, crazy runner. Darling, we're going to sell 500,000 copies of this book standing on our heads. All the big papers and mags are screaming for review copies. They've lost the ones we sent them 3 months ago. Doubleday are reprinting 50,000, and I told them they were crazy. It should have been 100,000. It's only just starting. Next week we'll see the West Coast catch fire, and they'll be screaming for copies across the whole country."
There was much more. Bobby Duggan riding high, shouting his plans and his hopes, while Deborah laughed weakly and kept saying,
"No, I can't believe it," and "It's not true."
They drank 3 bottles of Veuve Clicquot that night, and a little before midnight Deborah fell pregnant to David Morgan.
Miss Mordecai combines superb use of language and a sure literary touch with the readability of a popular bestseller, said the New York Times.
"Who says good literature has to be dull?" asked Time.
"Deborah Mordecai's talent burns like a clean white flame. Miss Mordecai takes you by the throat, slams you against the wall, throws you onto the floor and kicks you in the guts. She leaves you as shaken and weak as if you had been in a car smash," added the Free Press. Proudly, David presented Conrad Berg with a signed copy of A Place of Our Own. Conrad had finally been prevailed upon to drop the Mrs. Morgan and call Deborah by her given name. He was so impressed with the book that he had an immediate relapse.
"How do you think of those things, Mrs. Morgan?" he asked with awe.
"Deborah," Deborah prompted him.
"She doesn't think of them," Jane Berg explained helpfully. "It just comes to her. It's called inspiration."
Bobby Duggan was correct.
They had to reprint another 50,000 copies. It seemed as though the Fates, ashamed of the cruel pranks they had played upon them, were determined to shower Deborah and David with gifts. As Deborah sat at her olive wood table, growing daily bigger with her child, once again the words flowed as strongly and as crystal clear as the spring waters of the string of pearls. However, there was still time to help David with the illustrated publication he was compiling on the birds of prey of the bushveld, and to accompany him on the daily expeditions to different areas of Jabulani, and to plan the furnishings and the layout of the empty nursery. Conrad Berg came to her secretly to enlist her aid in his plan to have David nominated to the board of the National Parks Committee. They discussed it in length and great detail. A seat on the board carried prestige and was usually reserved for men of greater age and influence than David. However, Conrad was confident that the dignity of the Morgan name, combined with David's wealth, ownership of Jabulani, demonstrated interest in conservation and his ability to devote much time to the affairs of the board would prevail. Yes, Deborah decided. It will be good for him to meet people and get out a little more. We're in danger of becoming recluses here. Will he do it? Don't worry, Deborah assured him. I'll see to it. Deborah was right. After the initial uneasiness of the first meeting of the board, and once the other members became accustomed to that dreadful face and realized that behind it was a warm and forceful person, David gathered increasing confidence with each subsequent journey to Pretoria, where the board met. Deborah would fly up with him, and while they were at their deliberations, she and Jane Berg shopped for the baby and the other items of luxury and necessity that were not readily come by in Nelspruit. However, by November, Deborah was carrying low, and she felt too big and uncomfortable to make the long flight in the cockpit of the Navajo, especially as the rains were about to break and the air was turbulent with storm cloud and static and heavy thermals. It would be a bumpy trip, and she was deeply involved in the last chapters of the new book. I'll be perfectly all right here, she insisted. I've got a telephone, and I've also got 6 game rangers, 4 servants, and a fierce hound to guard me. David argued and protested for 5 days before the meeting, and agreed only after he'd worked out a timetable. If I leave here before dawn, I'll be at the meeting by 9. We'll be finished by 3, and I can be back here by 6:30 at the latest, he muttered. If it wasn't the budget and financial affairs vote, I'd cut it. Tell them I was sick. It's important, darling. You go. You're sure now? I won't even notice you're not here. Don't get too carried away by it, he told her ruefully. I might stay just to punish you. In the dawn, the thunderheads were the colour of wine and flame and ripe fruit, fuming and magnificent, towering high above the tiny aircraft, high above the utmost ceiling of which it was capable. David flew the corridors of open sky, alone and at peace, wrapped in the euphoria of flight which never failed for him. He altered course at intervals to avoid the mountainous upsurges of cloud. Within them lurked death and disaster, great winds that would tear the wings from his machine and send the pieces whirling on high, up into the heights where a man would perish from lack of oxygen. He landed at Grand Central, where a hire car was waiting for him, and spent the journey into Pretoria reading through the morning papers. It was only when he saw the meteorological prediction of a storm front moving in steadily from the Mozambique Channel that he felt a little uneasy. Before he entered the conference room, he asked the receptionist to place a telephone call to Jabulani. 2-hour delay, Mr. Morgan. Okay, well, call me when it comes through. When they broke for lunch, he asked her again. What happened to my call?
I'm sorry, Mr. Morgan, I was going to tell you. The lines are down. They're having very heavy rainfall in the low veld.
His vague uneasiness became mild alarm.
Would you call the meteorological office for me, please?
The weather was down solid. From Barberton to Mpunda Milia, and from Lorenzo Marks to Mashadadorp, the rain was heavy and unrelenting. The cloud ceiling was above 20,000 feet, and it was right down on the ground. The Navajo had no oxygen or electronic navigational equipment.
How long? David demanded of the meteorological officer. How long until it clears?
Hard to tell, sir. 2 or 3 days.
Damn, said David bitterly, and went down to the canteen on the ground floor of the government building.
Conrad Berg was at a corner table with 2 other members of the board, but when he saw David, he jumped up and limped heavily but urgently across the room.
David, he took his arm, and his round red face was deadly serious. I've just heard. Johan Akkers broke jail last night. He killed a guard and got clean away. He's been loose for 17 hours.
David stared at him, unable to speak with the shock of it.
Is Deborah alone?
David nodded, his face stiff with scar tissue, but his eyes dark and afraid.
You had better fly down right away to be with her.
The weather. They've grounded all aircraft in the area.
Use my truck, said Conrad urgently.
Oh, I need something faster than that.
Do you want me to come with you?
No, said David. If you aren't there this afternoon, they won't approve the new fencing allocations. I'll go on my own.
Deborah was working at her desk when she heard the wind coming. She switched off her tape recorder and went out onto the veranda with the dog following her closely. She stood listening, not sure of what she was hearing. It was a soughing and sighing, a far-off rushing like that of a wave upon a pebble beach. The dog pressed against her leg and she squatted beside him, placing one arm around his neck, listening to the gathering rush of the wind, hearing the roar of it building up swiftly, the branches of the marula forest beginning to thrash and rattle. Zulu whimpered, and she hugged him a little closer.
There, boy, gently, gently, she whispered,
and the wind struck in a mighty squalling blast, crashing through the treetops, tearing and cracking the upper branches. It banged into the insect screen of the veranda with a snap like a mainsail filling, and unsecured windows and doors slammed like cannon shots.
Deborah sprang up and ran back into her workroom. The window was swinging and slamming, dust and debris boiling in through it. She put her shoulder to it, closing it and securing the latch. Then she ran to do the same to the other windows and bumped into one of the house servants. Between them, they battened down all the doors and windows.
Madam, the rain will come now. It's very much rain.
Go to your families now, Deborah told them.
The dinner, madam.
Oh, don't worry, I'll make that. And thankfully they streamed away through the swirling dust to their hutments beyond the koppie. The wind blew for 15 minutes, and Deborah stood by the wire screen and felt it tugging and whipping her body. Its wildness was infectious, and she laughed aloud, elated and excited. Then suddenly the wind was past, as swiftly as it had come, and she heard it tearing and clawing its way over the hills above the pools. In the utter silence that followed, the whole world waited, tensed for the next onslaught of the elements. Deborah felt the cold, the sudden fall in temperature, as though the door to a great icebox had been opened, and she hugged her arms and shivered. She could not see the dense, dark cloud banks that rolled across Jabalani, but somehow she sensed their menace and their majesty in the coldness that swamped her. The first lightning bolt struck with a crackling electric explosion that seemed to singe the air about her, and Deborah was taken so unawares that she cried out aloud. The thunder broke, and seemed to shake the sky and rock the earth's very foundations. Deborah turned and groped her way back into the house, locking herself into her room, but walls could not diminish the fury of the rain when it came. It drummed and roared and deafened, battering the window panes and striking the walls and doors, pouring through the screen to flood the veranda. As overpowering as was the rainstorm, yet it was the lightning and the thunder that racked Deborah's nerves. She could not steel herself for each mighty crack and roar. Each one caught her off balance, and it seemed that they were aimed directly at her. She crouched on her daybed, clinging to the soft, warm body of the dog for a little comfort. She wished she had not allowed the servants to leave, and she thought that her nerve might crack altogether under the bombardment. Finally, she could stand it no longer. She groped her way into the living room. In her distress, she had almost lost her way about her own home, but she found the telephone and lifted it to her ear. Immediately, she knew that it was dead. There was no tone to it, but she cranked the handle wildly, calling desperately into the mouthpiece, until finally she let it fall and dangle on its cord. She began to sob as she stumbled back to her workroom, hugging the child in her big belly, and she fell upon the daybed and covered her ears with both hands.
"Stop it!" she screamed. "Stop it! Oh, please, God, make it stop!"
The new national highway, as far as the coal mining town of Witmunk, was broad and smooth, 6 lanes of traffic, and David eased the hired Pontiac into the fast lane and went flat, keeping his foot pressed down hard. She peaked out at 130 miles an hour, and she sat so solid upon the road that he hardly needed to drive her. His mind was free to play with horror stories, and to remember Johan Akka's face as he stood in the dock, glaring across the courtroom at them. The deep-set, muddy eyes, and the mouth working as though he were about to spit. As the warders had led him to the stairs down to the cells, he had pulled free and shouted back,
"I'm gonna get you, Scarface," he giggled. "If I have to wait 29 years, I'm gonna get you."
And they took him away.